The Asian Classics Institute presents The 7-Point Practice for Developing a Good Heart with Geshe Michael Roach. Recorded live in Goa, India. Session 1.
There's some prayers that you'll get in the book, I think after the first class. Okay. Okay. We just came from Kathmandu. Sorry, Bodh Gaya. And we had a very technical teaching. It was about Diamond Color Sutra. It was about emptiness. And, you know, it was a lot of details and a lot of this and that and complicated, you know. Then Goa seems a little bit different. And... then Bihar. And seems like we should change mood. So this class is about a thing called Lojong. Lojong is a special kind of Buddhist teaching from Tibet. It was designed, it was first taught openly about 1,000 years ago. And mainly it's just about, you know, when you come to Goa from Bihar, then suddenly your mind gets wider. You know, they say Kuyangbo in Tibetan means your mind just opens up and you feel more relaxed and everyone's like just more loose and less tense and people's clothing change. Roy's is, but no. And, you know, everybody who had a cold and was sick got better and you feel this kind of well-being, you know what I mean? For a few days. You feel this kind of relaxed or something different, you know. And then after a few days here, it starts to go away, okay? Because you get used to the place. I mean, and I remember I was, just before I went to India, the first time I was in Hawaii, and my brother was there. He was a very good surfer, and so I went there to surf with him, and we surfed for 6 months and smoked marijuana and ate crackers and peanut butter and lived off food stamps, and I couldn't stand it. It just drove me crazy. When I get to a place like this, I get nervous again, you know? And no, it just drove me crazy. I couldn't stand it. And I actually ran away. I actually just got in a car and went to the airport and gave my money and flew away, you know? And after that, my brother killed himself, you know what I mean? And I mean, a few months later, and he had it, everything perfect, you know? Everything was just perfect. You know, the waves there are perfect. The beach was perfect. He had two houses. He was watching two different mansions for different people. It was like Hawaii 5-0, you know? And, what's his name? Magnum P.I. Yeah. No, this rich guy gave him a house to watch, you know? It was a mansion on Hilo. And with its old private beach and everything. And after a while, you can't maintain that happy mind. There's something wrong. You know what I mean? And I don't know. I mean, and that's why I came to India. And when I saw everybody get diarrhea in Kathmandu and Bodhgaya, I was, you know, I felt like coming home. And I remembered that first trip and all the people I met and the attempt to try to get a happy state of mind and try to keep it for a while. You know what I mean? And I can't think of a better teaching than Lojong. So, I mean, hopefully the beach and the sun and the ocean will put you in a state of mind, like a happy state of mind. And then you can switch over to Lojong after about 3 days and try to stay there. You know what I mean? And Lojong is designed for that. And I personally, it's one of the sweetest parts of Buddhism. It's just more or less how to stay in a very happy state of mind all the time. So I'm going to write Tibetan on the board because two reasons. One is to impress you that I know what I'm talking about. And secondly, that you learn some Tibetan and then it stays in your mind. The seed stays in your mind, okay? So it's good for you. So also we have the stupid homework thing. And please do it, okay? Then the practice will stay with your mind. And we're going to go through a way to meditate on Lojong. It's divided out into a one-week practice. So, you know, like Monday is Compassion Day, Saturday is Emptiness Day, you know, Wednesday is Change Problems into Opportunities Day. And I'm going to teach you a special meditation based on Lojong. But first I thought you'd like to hear a little bit of history of this teaching, how it came to exist in Tibet. Who used to use it, what its name is, things like that. I think at the beginning of a class, it's good to hear about all that stuff. Then come on, you have time here on the beach. You can sit and do the homework. You can all sit in a circle and cheat, do it together. And, you know, please do it. Because then when you leave, you remember everything. And then you can actually do the meditations and things like that, okay? So first I want to tell you the word for Lojong. And I'll ask you to repeat the word, okay? Then it stays in your mind better. It sticks in your mind. Say Lojong. 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 Okay, Lojong has been translated many different ways. Some people say mental development. Some people say thought transformation. Some people say mental training. Lo means mind, and Jong means to practice something or to make something pure. And what it means in this case is Chanchu Dunya Gilojoa, very specific. It means to practice thinking like a bodhisattva. Okay? This lo doesn't mean general mind. It doesn't mean like mental training in the sense of SAT or college exam. When I heard mental training, I had in mind my college examinations or something like that. It means to practice thinking like a bodhisattva, okay? And the law means bodhicitta. It means a kind of ultimate love or ultimate compassion for other people, okay? So that's really, it's just trying to think that way. Trying to learn to think like Mother Teresa or somebody like Gandhi or something like that, okay? You ready? You want to do your thing? I'm going to write for you the enemy of Lojong, okay? And we'll be talking about him all during the course. Those of you who are learning Tibetan, the chalkboard is a good example because all the strokes should be made down. You see what I mean? When you're writing Tibetan with a bamboo pen, which is the word for pen in Tibetan is bamboo, you can only make strokes a certain way. You can't go back on it. So it's a way to get your calligraphy better, actually. Say Ran. Tenzin. Rang. Tenzin. Rang means myself. Just myself. Tanzin means cherishing, taking care of myself, watching out for myself, and not taking care of other people. Okay, this is the big enemy of Lojong. See, Lojong is trying to think like a compassionate person, and then Rang Tanzin is just thinking about yourself. And we all have it. It's rooted in what we call ignorance or not understanding emptiness. It's rooted in that. But it's an emotion where you're just thinking about yourself mainly and you're not thinking about other people. And if you want to keep the Goa state of mind, you know what I mean, that you have for the first 2 days here, like the difference it feels between here and Bihar, you know, if you want to keep that Kuyangbo feeling, that mellow feeling, happy feeling, it all depends on how much you can destroy Rang Tanzin. You know, how much can you repress, or how much can you diminish your tendency to take care of yourself and not think about other people? Because your happiness will be exactly that much. You see what I mean? So generally, since most of us haven't ever gone into a training course of how to stop thinking about yourself too much, then we have a very high Rang Tanzin and a proportionately low happiness level. So at the beginning, you can make a lot of progress. So I mean, in the first few weeks that you try Lojong, you can get rid of some very obvious tendencies to take care of yourself. Like when you eat cookies, you eat 10 and give one away or something. Or when you have tea, you pour yourself 3 teas and nobody else gets any. Or you know, you go to a hotel and you break all their stuff and leave, or something like that. Or you just don't think about it. And so our tendency to think about what we want is so strong in its natural form since birth. If no one ever told you about these things, and if no one ever trained you to stop doing it, you've got a long way to go. And so that's a good thing, because you can make a lot of progress just by starting to think about it, and then your happiness level will go up. So as Rang Tanzin goes down, happiness goes up. And they work like that. They work in a symbiotic relationship. Okay, the less you're worried about yourself, the more happy you get. You see what I mean? And that's just karma, and we can talk about that later. And since most of us don't think about it much, the minute you start thinking about it, you start getting happier right away. So the first few weeks are like dessert. And then you get down to, you know, your real tendency to take care of yourself first. And that's harder. Okay, so then the progress becomes more difficult, and then the happiness becomes more lasting. Okay, so anyway, even just this afternoon during the break, to start thinking about what other people would like to drink or eat or take care of somebody else, think about somebody else, you can immediately start to feel the happier. And then you'll get stuck in about 3 weeks, okay? Then you get down to the real tendency, and then that takes a lot of work. The purpose of this particular training is to anticipate that day. In about 3 weeks, if you practice it seriously, you'll get stuck against the real tendency to take care of yourself. And then we're going to talk about that one right now. First, I want to introduce you to, there are many kinds of Lojongs. There are, maybe 30 or 40 different famous Lojongs. And they've all been collected into a text in the 13th century by somebody named Muchen. And I'm going to just teach you one of them. Okay, I'm going to give you the name of that. Okay. Saying Lojong, Dung, Dunma. Lojong, Dung, Dunma. Okay, Lojong means Lojong. Okay. Practicing to think like a bodhisattva. And then Dung means points or steps. Okay. And then Dunma means seven. Seven. So seven, something's called 7-point training to think like a bodhisattva or something like that. Okay. Lojong Dung Dunma. Sometimes they shorten it to Dung Dunma, the 7 points. Okay. It's very, very short. It was obviously passed down verbally for a long time. Obviously it wasn't written down for a long time. And I want to tell you a little bit about the history of who wrote this Lojong. Up until 1100, it was called a Kagyama. All right. a new phrase. I don't think you've heard this one, most of you guys. Say Kagyama. 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 Ka means like the Ka and Kangyur, the canon, and it means the word of the Buddha, teaching. Okay, it can also mean a command of a king. Ka, the word. Okay, Gya means the Gya in Mahamudra, Chakya, Chembo, Chakya, Chembo, and it means mudra. Mudra means seal, like a stamp that you put on something. And Kagyama is a kind of sacred book in Tibet that was hidden, and they didn't show it to people. It means sealed text. And in Tibet, the government would take very controversial or very, in a sense, dangerous teachings that shouldn't be exposed to most people, and they would keep them under seal. So the book would have a seal on it. It was kept in Nopapala, and only special lamas could look at it and learn it, and that was called a Kagyama. So Kagyama means like a sealed text. It would have a special seal on it with a thread in it, and you'd have to break the thread to get into the text, and these are called Kagyama. So up until the 1100s, the book you're going to study was Kagyama. Okay, it was sealed, and it was passed on mostly by memory. People would memorize it and pass it on to the next generation. Okay. Kokchu is the same thing as a Kagyama. Kok means, those of you who know Buddhist logic, Kokyu means like hidden reality, or like emptiness is in the category of Kokyu. Kok means hidden or very deep or difficult to perceive. And then Chu means Dharma. Kokchu means a teaching that was kept under wraps. It was kept hidden from normal people for up to the 1100s. Okay, so the text you're going to study, Lojong Dunduma, was kept secret and passed on from people up until the 1100s. Okay, I'll tell you who's the first person who taught it according to the secret lineages, which were written down later by people like Pabongkor Gumbe or Wuchi Dhammapada. He says that this teaching actually originated with Lord Buddha. So the first person to teach Lojong Dunduma was Lord Buddha. He taught it to Maitreya, who in those days was disguised as a plain old bodhisattva, okay, student of Lord Buddha. And the next major figure in the lineage is Serlingba, Lama Serlingba, who lived in Indonesia. And as you may know, Lord Atisha went to study with him in around 1000 AD. So Lord Atisha took a very dangerous trip to Indonesia on a ship, came back with the teachings on bodhicitta, or compassion, and he learned that from Serlingba. So Serlingba passed it on to Lord Atisha. Lord Atisha, who was one of the great lamas from India who brought Buddhism to Tibet and stayed at Nalanda Monastery. He was the jewel of Nalanda Monastery, and the Tibetans talked him into coming to Tibet. Then a war broke out in Nepal, and he didn't get home for a long time. Actually, he was foretold that he would pass away in Tibet, and he stayed in Tibet for a long time. So he came from Nalanda. You saw the ruins, I think. Then it was passed on to his great disciple, Dromtenje. Dromtenje is a very interesting figure in Buddhism in Tibet. He facilitated Lord Atisha's mission in Tibet. Like, every time Lord Atisha needed money or food or a few donkeys or a yak to carry things, this guy would show up at the last minute, you know. Reminds me of some people like in New York and Australia, Mongolia, people that show up at the last minute when you're having your teaching, and, you know, suddenly the money's there or the stuff you need is there. They look a lot like Dromtenje. Dromtenje is interesting. He never became a monk. He was a layman. And in the pictures of the lamas of the lineage, you can always tell him, even without the caption, because he's got a ponytail. He's got this bun, and his hair is tied back, and he looks at him like an amazing person. He built helped Atisha build one of the great monasteries of Tibet called Rajang. And it was at Rabdang that Jetsun Kapa later wrote Lamrim Chenmo and the Yaminshi Gyuma and other great texts. So it passed down to Dzongtunje. Dzongtunje is like the grandfather of all the Kadampa lamas. Kadampas were the like these fanatical first Tibetan Buddhists who risked their lives to go to India and came back. And they would go, and somebody would go to Kashmir, or somebody would go to Bengal, or somebody would go to Bihar, and they would come back with different teachings, you know, like somebody would come back with two of the tantras, and somebody else would come back with Buddhist logic, and somebody else would come home with perfection of wisdom. And then they spread this germ, virus, among each other. To draw the family tree of the Kadampa Lamas is impossible, because it looks like a tumbleweed, because they would just teach each other. You see what I mean? It's like as if some Westerners went to India and they each came back with a different teaching, and then they taught it to each other first, and then they started spreading it to other people. Some of the great Kadampa Lamas who spread this teaching were named Pokawa and Sharawa. And if you want to see their pictures, Elizabeth Heinberg, where is she? Did you do it yet? No. She took digital photographs with Rob of all of these lamas from great scriptures, and Lama Supa asked them to fax them to Root Institute because they want to make some statues of these early Kadampa lamas, and they don't know what they look like, you know. So you got to get Potowa. That's why you have to get Dzongtunje, Potowa, and then Sharawa. And these people lived between 1000 AD and 1100 AD. So the teaching you're going to learn was passed on for that long. You can say 16 centuries, privately, quietly, from person to person. And you can see it in the text. The text is extremely, it feels old, and it feels very, the words are very ancient. And this thing is obviously meant to be memorized. It's very short, you know. I mean, the root text is only a few pages, one or two pages. 2 pages in English, okay? And English is fast. You know, English takes a lot more than Tibet. Then you're going to have a commentary that we found. Commentaries are kind of rare on this. By the way, after it was written down, some of the great people who taught it were the fifth Dalai Lama, who's called the Great Fifth, and Muochu Dhammabhadra, who's a big lama in your Vajradhini lineage. Those of you who are studying Vajradhini, supposed to be a former life of Pabongkor Rinpoche. And then Pabongkor Rinpoche passed it down to Chijang Rinpoche, Chijang Rinpoche to my root lama, Ken Rinpoche Geshen Losam Tarchin, who passed it on to us. So you're now the next person in the lineage. It's a direct oral chain. Rinpoche had in his private papers, a commentary on the Gojong Dungduma, which he allowed us to copy. That's what your reading is. It's old. I don't know who wrote it. There's not even, you know, we've got thousands of catalogs in the electronic database now. We can't identify who wrote it. Apparently it was passed down secretly also. So it's a very interesting commentary that you'll get in the reading. Okay. I'd like to tell you a little bit about the person who finally wrote it down. In the 1100s, there was a lama named Chikawa, Geshe Chikawa. Say Geshe.
Geshe.
Chikawa.
Chikawa.
Geshe.
Geshe.
Chikawa.
Chikawa.
By the way, the word Geshe, in the days of the Kadampas, before the Kadampas in India, it was Kalyana Mitra, and it means spiritual friend. And then when the Kadampas began, Geshe became a title for like a learned Kadampa scholar or teacher. And then when the first great monasteries of the Gelupas were built in the 1400s, Sera was built in the early 1400s, I think 1412, which you're going to visit next on your trip. It became a title for a person who had mastered 5 great books. It used to be 10 great books, and it got shortened to 5. So it used to be Kachupa, meant to master the 10 great books, which even nowadays no one can identify for me. I've asked many people, what are they? Not only are there no Kachupas around, there's nobody who knows exactly what the 10 were. Then it became a Kangapa, which is a master of the five great books, which is what the Geshe course is now. And several people here today have finished that whole course. They'll be taking their final exams in February. Hope you're all nervous. Okay. You can spell Geshe Chikawa's name several different ways, so if you ever see it a different way, don't worry about it. I'll give you his dates. He took this teaching, Lojong Dendima, and he started to teach it to a lot of his students, and then eventually he was into helping people with leprosy, people with lepers, and he found that if they understood the meaning of the Lojong properly, as I'll try to convey to you, okay, if you understand this teaching in its context of emptiness, you know, if you understand the emptiness of this teaching, you can actually use it to transform not just your state of happiness, but even physical problems. So he began to teach this Lojong to people with leprosy and cured a lot of them. A lot of them used this Lojong. They started to do this meditations, the seven meditations, and they began to get cured. So the teaching began to be called Zeche. Ze means leprosy. And Che means Dharma. So they call it the leprosy Dharma. And it got to be such a big thing that I think in the text it says that he decided that he should make it public. He took off the Kagyama. He took off the seal, you know, and then he decided that this is so beneficial and that people by his generation seem to be capable of learning it properly, that he decided to make it public. And then it became a tsokche. Tsokche means something you can teach in public, okay, as opposed to a kokche. So he began to teach it to the public. Okay. What was the problem up till then? You know, why go, 16 centuries without teaching it to anyone? It's a very subtle thing. The most basic principle of this teaching is that it makes sense to take care of other people before you take care of yourself. Okay? That it's a holy action, a sacred act, to think about other people before you think about yourself. And that's the whole point of this lojo. You know, the whole point of what we're going to do for the next 4 or 5 days, all the teachings you're going to get, all the things I'm writing on, the whole point of everything is to try to learn how to think about other people first and how to think about yourself second. You see what I mean? And that's the most sacred teaching there is in Buddhism. Up to the time of Geshe Chikawa, the great lamas checked the people living around them and they realized that they couldn't get it. You see what I mean? They realized that if they got up and said, if you're really intelligent, you would take care of other people first and then take care of yourself. And that's the key to happiness, is to watch out for what other people need first and always be thinking about other people and then think of yourself second, is the key to happiness. And they checked the people around them. They checked the people that were living in their times and the people that they could reach with this teaching. And they made a decision that they couldn't understand it. Loa Michumba means, it's a very common expression in Buddhism, meaning they didn't have enough goodness to grasp what was going on, and they would take it the wrong way. They would reject it. You see, I mean, they would think it was foolish or naive or letting yourself be taken advantage of by other people if you put them first and you put yourself second. They recognized, they have this power to judge a disciple's aptitude, a disciple's goodness, how much they can understand. And then there are many, many, many levels of Dharma that are not being taught even now. Okay, they're called kokchu, or they understand that a normal person wouldn't be able to handle that teaching. They would disrespect it, you see? And there are many teachings even now, there are many ways of practicing Dharma that are still Kagyama, that are still kokchu, and not passed down in public and just given to special disciples, because other people wouldn't understand it. They would misinterpret it, or they think it was crazy, or something dirty, or something illogical, or something naive. And so there are still a lot of teachings like that. By Geshe Chikala's time, and I think because of his success with the lapras and things, he judged that there were enough people around who were good enough to understand it that he started to teach it openly. Okay, so that if somebody asked, you know, why keep Lojong secret for 16 centuries, it's that most people, when you start talking about this idea that you could be happier if you would stop thinking about yourself and take care of other people first, they would just reject it outright. Offhand, they would reject it because it just sounds crazy. I sometimes sit and fantasize about the first person who discovered it. I fantasize about this caveman up on a hill, and he kills a deer and he's eating it, and it's very hard to get deer or something like that. And then the deer rolls off the cliff and falls down to the next caveman's cave, and he takes it and eats it, and then the first guy the next day gets two deer, you know, and he's like this genius caveman, and he figures out that it's because he gave away one deer, and he got two deer the next day. Like, imagine who'd be the first person to imagine that by giving away something you get more back. You see what I mean? By watching out for other people, you would get everything you ever dreamed of. You see what I mean? And then you take it for granted that cars exist, or spacecraft exist, or, you know, laser discs exist and things. You take it for granted. You assume that you would be intelligent enough to make them or invent them. But really, people who can make leaps of genius like that, like Da Vinci or Columbus or people like Galileo, who can see the world in a whole new way, are very rare. You know, for someone to discover electricity or something, is you use it all the time, so you think you're smarter than people who didn't use electricity, but we're not smart enough to think of those things. It was one extraordinary person who saw a new pattern or a new way of looking at things, like Edison. And these are the people who practiced the Lojong in the early years, people who made this leap of intellect to realize that you can get what you want, or you can become happier if you stop worrying about yourself and start taking care of other people first. You see what I mean? And it's such a difficult idea, and it's so unnatural and abnormal for us that you tend to just reject it. You know, like, you're polite enough not to leave right now, but whether or not you'll do it is another question. And that's why it was kept secret so long. The karma of hearing it and then disrespecting it is very, very grave. It's very bad. It's very serious bad karma to hear about this idea and then reject it. You know, I mean, to actively say it's stupid. Well, the most common objection you hear is it's naive to think that by taking care of other people, I will get what I want. You know, especially like in business or something. You know, if you go to a businessman and you say, which I have been in business for 15 years in New York, corporation, right? And to express some of these ideas, you know, like the best way to have a successful company is to take each individual employee and find out what they would most like to happen with their lives, or what thing would make them most happy and most satisfied with their career, and to make that the main emphasis of your company. It's just such a strange idea to most people that they would reject it. And to reject it is a very serious bad karma. This is one of the keys to the universe. You know, this is one of the laws as great as gravity or something. And then to spit on it, to reject it, is a very serious bad karma. So that's why it was kept secret for so long. Lamas identified among their students, they chose those who would grasp it, who would not disrespect it, and who would not see it in the wrong way. And then they taught it to them slowly. And that's how it was passed on. Then by Geshe Chikawa's time, he judged that there were enough people around who saw its benefit that he began to teach it openly. And that's why we have it now as an open teaching. Okay? So that's a little history of Lojong Dunduma. I'm going to go on to the first of the 7 points. And in each class we'll do one or more of the 7 points. We've also organized the 7 points into a series of meditations that you can do every week. I'm going on a long retreat in March, 3-year silent retreat, and mostly silent. And you know, a lot of my students are coming and saying, "What should I do? You know, I don't know what to do. You taught a lot of stuff, but you know, do you have like a schedule or a proposal for a meditation practice?" This is one that's very, very holy, very sacred. It's very deceptive in that it looks very simple, but it's a very, very nice one. So if you have in mind, you know, what am I going to do when we get back from Sarah? You know, what am I going to do with my life? What am I going to do with my daily practice? This is a very appropriate one. You know, you can take this to be the one that I think would be the most useful for most people here. Okay? This Lojong Dundima, very brief, very simple, very appropriate for a person in the West who has a family or a job and who's busy, and but still needs something very powerful. Okay? And you'll find that if you practice it well, it has a mental benefit, and then it has a physical benefit. If it can cure leprosy, which it did, it could definitely cure your personal problems. You know, and I've seen it many times, physical problems. People with bad backs or bad knees or other health problems, that it can do both. It can take care of the mental part and it takes care of the physical part. I don't think you can be really happy if you feel bad physically, right? I mean, that would be part of it, right? And it has an effect on equal on both. And why it has that effect, we'll be talking about it. So the first of the 7 steps, okay? I'll just mention it. I'll do a little bit about it, and then I'd like to take a break, and you guys can have something to drink or something to eat, and then we'll start again. I'll read you the root text. It's exactly one line long, okay? It says, by the way, I'll also give you the loom as we go, okay? So you'll have the oral transmission. Okay, there's 2 parts to getting a teaching in a lineage, right? If I teach you the meaning, then you become the next person in the link, in chain, of people who've learned this and practiced it. That's by explaining it. And then I'll read the text out loud, and then you get the oral transmission also, as I received it from my teacher, who received it from the Dalai Lama's teacher, who received it from Pabongkor Yatsui, who's a couple of generations up in Mujidharabhadra, and then it goes back like that, back to Geshe Chikawa and before that. So, first line, Dambo Mundo Dala La, that's all. Okay. Did you catch that? Dambo Mundo Dala La. Dambo means first. Mundo means preliminary practices. Okay. Dak means there's going to be more than one. Dala La means you have to train yourself in the preliminary practices, okay? And this is referring to how you start the meditation. So this will be Sunday morning, okay? You're going to get a sheet that will give you all the days, but Sunday is called, what do they call it? Foundation Day. Okay, foundation means there's 3 meditations that you can choose from on Sundays, okay? And that will be all meditations from the first line, you know, first you have to study the preliminaries, okay? In the preliminaries, there are 3 different kinds of meditation, and you can do any one. So I'd say, you know, on the first Sunday of the month, do one, maybe on the next Sunday, do another one. And the way to choose them is by how you feel at the time, okay? The first of the 3 meditations is called a rejoicing meditation. Lama Sopa is very big on this. We asked him for 3-year retreat advice a couple of weeks ago, a week ago, and it was at the end of the interview. We had like 3 minutes, and we said, "By the way, do you have any advice?" And that was a mistake, right? And he went on for 2 hours or something. And but he was very big on the rejoicing one. Okay, it's I'll show it to you later. It's called Dandra. Dandra literally means thinking about everything that's going right with your life, you know, like thinking about little progresses you've made, thinking about how fortunate you are, thinking about how lucky you are to be alive, how lucky you are to have a decent brain, how lucky you are to be fairly healthy, how lucky you are to be exposed to the Dharma, to be in a place where Dharma is taught, And we'll go through that after the break. So that would be the first meditation. That's advice for people who are getting a little down. You know, like if you're, if Sunday comes and you don't feel very good on Sunday morning, choose this one. Okay? And that's supposed to be a good, especially in deep meditation, antidote for gross forms of what we call mental dullness, Qinghua, which is a number one, it's one of the most serious obstacles to meditation. This is where you feel sleepy because you didn't sleep enough on Saturday night, right, Lori? No. You ate too much on the weekend or something like that. When you feel lassitude or bored or dull, or also if you don't feel very happy, if you feel sort of depressed, then you should choose the first one, which is rejoicing meditation. Okay. Second one is called Chiwa Mitakwa, and I'll go through them. This is a death meditation. And, you know, like everybody else in America, I got a hold of the Tibetan Book of the Dead before I met these lamas. And it talked about all these purple lights and green lights and yellow lights. By the way, later they told me don't read that book. It's wrong. There are other books about the death process which are correct. But that one is known among the lamas to be mistaken. So just forget that one. Okay, you can get a better one from... There are like 20 better ones. That one happens to be have a lot of errors in the presentation. So they say, don't learn that one. Okay. And if you learn Vajradhini Tantra or other tantras, you can learn a proper death meditation. So I thought death meditation was, you know, like close your eyes and pretend that there's an IV hooked up to you and hear the beep, 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 and then hear it go flat, you know. And then, you know, imagine seeing all this weird stuff. And there is a meditation like that. You can learn it later, okay? That's not what death meditation is. We're going to go through a good death meditation. Death meditation is good for people who have trouble prioritizing their life, especially people who are too busy. You know, if your life seems too busy and you seem like you're having trouble concentrating on anything, like at the end of the day you feel like you haven't accomplished anything, maybe you've done a lot, but 3 days later you can't remember what you did 3 days before, or you have trouble, you know, getting your life organized and doing the most important things first, prioritizing your life. If you have trouble like that, death meditation is very good. Okay? And it has an effect, which we'll talk about, of just cleaning your life out and organizing your life so that your life becomes very simple and clear and you feel very powerful. Okay, that's a death meditation. The third choice, when you say Dhammo Mundo Dala La, the third choice is called a suffering meditation. Okay, like if you're and this is a special meditation on all the sufferings of this life. There are many versions of this. I'm going to teach you the one by the first Panchen Lama. He lived, I think he was born in 1565 or something like that. His name was Panchen Losam Chukyi Gyantsen. And he taught this suffering meditation using six different sufferings. And most of them are mental. Okay, and he taught it that way. I personally find it to be a very compelling meditation on suffering. And I think you will too, because it really emphasizes the kinds of sufferings that a person would have if they were already wealthy. You know, if they were already healthy and handsome or beautiful but still didn't feel happy. He goes through a very good suffering meditation. I think this meditation is especially useful if you're having doubts about your life. Okay? If you're not sure you're doing the right thing with your life in general. You know, they call it tetsongi, nyambo means. It's a antidote for having second thoughts or misgivings about the way your life is going. And I think oftentimes we, especially if you've learned Dharma, especially if you just started Dharma, I remember I went from a big university, you know, very expensive university. I could have gone on to be a professor in many different places, and instead I went to Howell, New Jersey, which is this little, town. There's not even a town. It's three pizza shops on a highway. And I'm not kidding. Okay. And And it's nothing. It's nowhere, you know. And I had a lot of doubts when I first got there. You know, I'd walk around this llama's house, and the neighbor had all these junk cars in their backyard, and I slept in this garage, and I had to save the poo-poos for the morning because the toilet would only take number one. And it was, and I had a lot of doubts, you know. I was like, maybe I'm doing the wrong thing, you know, to sit here and live in these conditions and study Dharma, you know. Maybe I'm crazy, because all my friends thought I was crazy, and I wasn't making any money at all, and they all went on to become very successful lawyers and business people and very wealthy. And then doing a suffering meditation sort of puts your heart at ease. You know, it lets you come to a feeling of being sure that you've done the right thing, that you're concentrating on Dharma. You know, that Dharma is a big part of your life. You know, that you're not strange or weird, or your way of life is not something that's crazy or doesn't make sense. If you really do a good suffering meditation, I don't think afterwards you would have any doubts that you made the right choice. I'm not saying you can't work. I mean, my lama forced me to go to work and work in a normal office, and I'm very happy and glad that he did. And you can have a family, you can have a good job, you can have a meaningful career, but still your focus in life and what you do at work is mostly to think about things like lojo, is to concentrate on deeper things, even at work. So you're almost like meditating all day, even while you work. So, and to not have doubts about the path you've chosen, and to be sure that you've done the right thing. If you feel yourself having some doubts that maybe, you know, when you look at your credit card bills and, you know, and then you realize all your friends have gone on to these big houses and big jobs and careers, and you're like, you know, hanging out and going, well, you know. So sometimes you get doubts, you know. Sometimes you feel like, maybe I didn't do the right thing, you know. And then this meditation is very good for that. It's a suffering meditation. And then it just clears up right away. You know you're on the right track. Okay? You know you're in the right ballpark. You may not be doing it very well, but you made the right choice. As I get older, by the way, many of those same classmates call me and ask me for help. And recently, one of them who became a 100 millionaire called me and came to the Dalai Lama's talk and asked me to take care of one of his children and things like that. You know, after 20 years, you know, he realized that was a better path. And he said that, and it was very overwhelming to hear that, you know. Okay, so take a break, about 10 minutes. I think we'll ring some kind of bell. Do you have Namgyela? Oh, well, we'll jump on the roof. Are there any, is there a place to get refreshments or anything? Is there a place outside to get refreshments? Yeah, you can go downstairs and out to the back, and there's Cokes. And so go have like 10, 15 minute break, and then come back. And we'll actually go through with those three meditations very briefly. Okay. Please say Dhyanjoy. Dhyanjoy. Okay. Dhyanjoy is good. It's one of the three meditations you can choose. This is going to be on Sundays. Sorry. Yeah, Sundays. It's called Rejoicing Meditation. And it's good to do if you're down, if you're feeling down. Okay. Also, I have people come to me, either your meditation is dull, like you get sleepy, or you get bored, or you feel anxiety, or you get minor kinds of loom, you know, like wind disease, and you starts to, like, get tight, and you feel like you can't meditate, like everything's too tight, then they say, do Dhyanjoy, okay. This is a technical thing from Lam Rim. There are, you know, 18 downdoors. These are called leisures and fortunes. And some of them are hard to relate to. You know, like one of them is, you weren't born as a hell being, so you should be happy. You know, and I mean, most Westerners don't really believe in hells. We'll talk about what those beings are and why it's serious that you could have been a hell being. But in the meantime, the way Lama Sopa presented it to us in one of the teachings he gave to us was just sit down in the morning, think about five things that are going well in your life. You know, like be happy about five things. For example, my health is not so bad. You know what I mean? Like, okay, I have this problem or that problem, but generally speaking, my health is not so bad. Generally, when people wake up in the nighttime, we say that your mind is vulnerable to negative thoughts, especially there's a period. Buddhism recognizes a number of periods during the night. There's the initial sleep period, and then there's a sleep period without dreams, and then there's a dreaming period, and then there's a lighter sleep period, and there's a waking period, and there are between, I think, say 2 and 4 o'clock, your mind is in a state of consciousness which is vulnerable to negative thoughts. So, I mean, personally, if I happen to wake up around 3 or 4 just because someone banged a door or something, I start to have worries about my life, or I start to think about problems I have or something like that. And they seem very serious, like they might keep me awake for an hour. And then if I fall back to sleep and I wake up at, if I wake up late, then and if I have a good tea, then nothing seems, they all go away. You know, like I don't even think of one of them. I can't remember what they were. You know what I mean? And this is a very good meditation for that. It's like if you're waking up in the morning and you still have some of that vulnerable state of mind left, which means that you're still having some problems or doubts or worries in your mind about. Normally, it happens if you're a working person on Monday morning or Sunday night. You know, is when you get these demons come to you and they start giving you. You start worrying. You feel a little down, or life seems like a big problem or something like that. So this is this Lama Zopa thing. Think of 3 to 5. Somebody told me that's not Lama Zopa. I heard on an Oprah Winfrey. So I'm not sure which one started it. But, you know, get up and think about 3 or 5 good things that are really going nice. You know, like you out of 10 million people met authentic Tibetan lamas. You know what I mean? Lama Sherpa, Lama Yeshe, His Holiness. You know, you, out of 10 million people waking up in your time zone, you met them. So you have a chance. You know what I mean? And just instead of worrying about some problem you have at work or someone you don't like or something like that, then reflect, you know, for a few minutes. I, out of 10 million people, I ran into real Tibetan lamas, you know, and they taught me really sweet things. And then it's just a way to start your day. It's called Pemba Thang. Pemba Thang means get off to the right start in the morning. And Lama Sopa said to do it before you open your eyes. So you're lying on your bed and you wake up and don't even get up. Just sit there. You can do it on your back, you know, sit there and think. See, I do this a lot. I say, I refuse to get up until I think of 5 good things that are going well in my life. You know what I mean? Because normally your mind jumps straight to a problem you're having with somebody or something like that. So, and then you'll find out that you have hundreds and hundreds of nice things are happening to you. And your negative mind wants to think about the 3 problems you have. You know, you have hundreds of opportunities today and hundreds of beautiful things are happening to you. But the minute you wake up, your mind is thinking about the 3 things that are not going very well. And just tell them to shut up and think about something sweet, okay? We'll do a few real meditations. You have to know how to set the room up. You have to know how to set the altar up. You know how to blow your nose right. You have to know how to set your cushion properly, how to sit properly. We'll go through that. That's assumed, okay? When I'm going to give you, there's a guy named Ori here who's going to Xerox the meditation instructions, but you'll get them tomorrow at this time, okay? So I'm not going to go through that now, but you have to do those preliminaries. If you don't do it on your bed, do it on your meditation cushion. There's a warm-up you have to do, meditation warm-up, like stretching, but it's mental. And then you go into the, we'll do that, I'll teach you that later this evening. And then you go into your meditation. So it's very simple. This first meditation, just 3 or 5 things that are going right in your life. And then close out the meditation, get up, go to work. Okay? Like that. And it's very, very, very profound for your level of happiness. To start your day right is one of the most important teachings of the Lodzen Dugyma. It's called the Pema Tang. As you die, you use the same principle. And we'll talk about that, I think it's in the fourth or fifth class. But it's how to use the same principle as you die, okay? When you're actually in the death process, okay? Okay, now meditation number two. Say chiwa. Mitapa. Chiwa. Mitapa. This one is good if you find that you have trouble doing your Dharma practice, getting motivated to do your Dharma practice, things like that. If you have trouble, also if you find yourself too busy or too scattered. I teach mainly in New York City, and that's probably the most common problem in New York City is that people have, they're very talented normally, they're very intelligent, and because of that, they've met a lot of interesting people, and they've gotten themselves into a lot of interesting projects, and it's how do you prioritize your life? How do you simplify your life? Chiwa Mitapa is a really good thing. Chiwa means death, okay? Chiwa means death. Mitapa means you are impermanent, okay? Mitapa means you're not going to last. And again, this is one that you could do on Sundays, and you sit in your bed. You can do it either formal meditation or if you have to get up early to go to a baseball game or something, you can just do it laying there, you know. And a lot of great lamas that I know, like one time I stayed in a room with the abbot of Serame, and we were at a hotel in Bangalore, and he before he wakes up, he sleeps, he lies there, and he does his death meditation, you know, and he doesn't open his eyes, he just does it. And it's, death meditation is very interesting. The word death meditation is, I think, deceiving. It's not like you pretend you're going to die or pretend that you're dying or something like that. It's that you go through a three-step meditation, okay? First one is to decide, I have to die, okay? I will die. I have to die. It's not technically true, okay? It's not technically true. When we leave Serame and we're going to Singapore, those of you who don't know, it's an 18-hour layover, so they captured me, the Dharma Center there, and we're going to do Heart Sutra for the whole day. And we're going to do the part where it says, which means you don't have to die. You don't have to get old. You just have to figure out how to stop it. And we're going to concentrate on that one line. So technically it's not true that you have to die, but it's good for death meditation if you say, I have to die. Okay, have to die. That's the first point. Then you will be more likely to get serious about your practice. Okay? You get serious. Second part is I don't know when. I don't know when I'm going to die. And then they say it enables you to start acting today. Get going today. And the last part of that meditation is only Dharma helps when you die. Only the Dharma helps when you die. There's nothing else that's going to help you, okay? All other things become irrelevant. How much money you have, how many friends you have, how much influence you have, what country you live in, you know, whether you're healthy or you're not healthy, what color your hair is, things like that. They just become, in the last moment of your life, they become canceled. Everything is canceled. You're back on a level with all the ants who died today and all the rats who died today and all the millionaires who died today. And you're all at exactly the same place, which is zero. You're back to ground zero. And you have the same status as all the dogs who died that day in India. You know what I mean? You are exactly on the same level with them. You're just another dead thing. You don't own anything. You don't have a body anymore. You don't live in a wealthy country anymore. You're just back to zero. Okay? And at that moment, the only thing you can possibly take with you is any kind of realizations you have in your mind. See, because your mind doesn't stop. So the only baggage, it's not true, you can't take anything with you. You take your thoughts with you and your karma. So whatever thinking patterns you've developed during your life, that's the only thing you can take with you. Okay. So knowing that, you would try to choose dharma over other activities. You know, when faced with, I had to drive a lot in cars in the last few weeks. And, you know, in India, a decent car ride is 11 hours long or something. And I had a choice of spacing out or trying to read the computer or trying to study a text. And when I got out the computer, it was impossible. And then I tried to pull out a book, and it was painful. You know what I mean? Because there's like going like that, you know. And there's certain parts of Bihar that doesn't matter. You couldn't read it anyway. And it was unpleasant. You know, it was hard to read it. And I knew I was going to get a headache, and I did get a headache. But then I think, well, what's the choice? You know what I mean? Am I going to waste a day? Am I going to waste a day of my life just staring out the window? You know what I mean? Or should I try to fix my mind? You know, should I try to do something with my mind? Even though it hurts, it probably doesn't hurt as much as it's going to hurt later in my life when I'm less healthy. Probably reading in a car, driving to Bihar, is not as bad as my normal day is going to be in 10 or 20 years. So I might as well use it. You see what I mean? And that's, you just choose not to waste your time. You choose at any given moment that this is more important. And if it hurts a little bit, it hurts a little bit. That's one of the kinds of the fourth perfection. If it hurts a little bit to do dharma, don't worry about it. I mean, be a little bit tough. It's going to hurt a lot more next year. If you're not doing tantra, okay? In other words, it's going to only get worse, so I might as well do it now, okay? Do your practice now, okay? They present the death meditation this way. When you study it with a really good lama, as I remember studying it with this abbot that I stayed with in the room. By the way, he's the one who passed away while we were in Kathmandu. Okay? So he was ready. And every morning he would sit there and he would say, this is a real death meditation, okay? And really it boils down to this. And you don't have to do more than this. I'm going to die today. By 6 o'clock. I'll be dead. And just decide. You know what I mean? A real death meditation is not to picture colors, or to imagine turning into a spirit, or floating around your body and, you know, crying, or, you know, something that's not like that. Real, real, real death meditation, as described by Jatsangkhapa in the Lama Nyingma, in the final paragraphs of it, he says, it's really, you just sit on your bed, lay on your bed, you don't open your eyes, and you say, I'm going to die at 6 o'clock today. Now what should I do? You know, just decide, I'm going to die today. Now what should I do? Okay, and then there's this pattern I've noticed among people who really do it, and there's very few people who really do it. Lots of people nod when I'm teaching, and then they put the book away and go to the beach. You know, by the way, you can do a death meditation on the beach too. I'm not saying that; it's probably a good place. But you just decide I'm going to die tonight at 6 o'clock. Now, what should I do? I have 3 hours left, or 2 hours left. What should I do? What should I do with the time? I mean, and I see this pattern. First of all, if you really do this for a couple of weeks, if you really lay on your bed in the morning, you would start to try all the things you ever wanted to try, like bungee jumping, or parachuting, and skydiving. What's that? Sailing. Parasailing. All the things certain kinds of drugs that you haven't tried yet. You know, I mean, you might say, what the hell, I'm going to die at 6 o'clock. I'll go to a disco in New York, you know. I'll see what it looks like, you know what I mean? I think if you were really, really honest to do this meditation, you would try the things you never tried. And then you'd get bored in about, you know, a week or 2 weeks. You'd try all these different things. You'd try, you know, all the things you ever wanted to try. I mean, if you really believed you were going to die. And then I think you would start to look for other things. And I think in the end, you would end up with bodhicitta or something. You'd end up sitting at home thinking about the suffering of other people or something. Because that's really what makes a difference, that what's meaningful. That's why people, when they get old, rich people, they start to give away their money and they start to get very charitable. And it's a natural thing for people who believe they're going to die. So, by the way, somewhere between giving away all your stuff and trying that drug you didn't try, between there, you would throw out all the stuff in your house. You know, who needs it? You're going to die tonight. Give it away. Make it meaningful. We're going on 2-year retreat. It's really been fun. I think every one of us did it in 3 levels. We gave away all the easy stuff, or threw it out. Then we gave away the stuff that hurt to give a little bit. You know, like, you know, high school girlfriend's picture and stuff like that. And then the last thing was, you know, like you have a little bit of too much Dharma articles. Like you got 2 bells and 2 dorjes and you don't really need them. And that was the hardest thing to give away. And then suddenly you feel great. You know, you feel like you could die tonight. You know, if you believed you're going to die tonight, I think you'd clean out your house. You throw out about 90% of the stuff. You don't use it. I think there should be this system where you put a sticker on all the things you own. And then when you use it, you take it off. And then a month later, you see which stuff still has stickers on it. And just throw it out. You see what I mean? Because it's just more cluttering up your head. You see what I mean? You can't meditate if you have too many things. So a real death meditator, I think, would start to throw away all their things. And then I think you would quit your job. And you would do what you really want to do. You know what I mean? If you knew it didn't matter, then I think you'd be willing to take a cut, 50% pay cut or something, easily, happily. You'd say, I don't care. I really wanted to write poetry. So I'll start writing poetry for a couple of weeks, a couple hours. You see what I mean? I think if you did a really good death meditation every day, you would, after about 3 months, you'd end up doing the things you really wanted to do, and you'd be happier anyway. You see what I mean? So consider it like a gift, the death meditation. Every morning, wake up, don't open your eyes, and just review your life and say, I'm going to die at 6 o'clock. What should I really be doing today? And I don't mean in an obligation way. Like, what would I really like to do today? And I think if you just follow the things that are pleasurable to you, like try certain pleasures that you haven't experienced yet, I think you'll quickly get the bodhicitta. I think after a few weeks or months, you'd start to get into deep meditation and bodhicitta as being the most pleasant thing you can do with the last day of your life. Okay? So try it. That's a death meditation. Sit in the morning, decide you're going to die at 6 o'clock, and then do what makes you happy. Do what makes you really happy. And you'll end up serving other people within a few months, because you'll find out that that's what makes you really happy.
Session 1 continues on the next CD.